Welcome to the How to Hide a Dead Body podcast. I am Isaac Brudansky, founder and CEO of Adventure Media. I'm joined, as I usually am, by Patrick Gilbert, Adventure Media COO. Patrick recently published a book, Join or Die, Digital Advertising in the Age of Automation. You can get yourself a copy on Amazon. We're going to talk a little bit about the book today. Most importantly, we're going to talk about the last chapter of the book. So Patrick, tell us the title of the last chapter. And when you first wrote your first draft of that last chapter, what did you want to convey to your readers? What did you want to send them off with in the last chapter of your book? Because it's not just a book about techniques. It's a book about techniques, strategies, but also your own personal growth, the agency's growth, meaningful work, meaningful relationships. So how did you want to send readers off?
Last chapter was originally just titled, I think it was Epilogue. And your comment to that was, everyone's going to stop reading it if you basically conclude the book. So I actually had to come up with a different title. So the name of the last chapter is technically called Onwards. It's broken up into three different sections. I think the one that's most relevant to this conversation is the very final piece, which is called It's Time to Build, which is an ode to an essay that Marc Andreessen published about, a little over a year ago at the height of the pandemic, calling out business leaders, politicians, and really just the overall Western civilization for not having pulled their weight in getting society to a place where we could combat something like the COVID-19 pandemic. And he was calling attention to people saying that it's ludicrous that we don't have basic supplies and healthcare products and PPE equipment and masks.
And, so he was writing. He was writing about in reference to the pandemic.
He was writing in reference to the pandemic, but it was a larger kind of thought piece about the smug complacency that he feels plagues healthcare and education and just really all of Western civilization about how the reason we don't have all these great things that we've envisioned is because there's been a lack of motivation, and the way he describes it is that there's been a lack of people willing to build, as he refers to it.
Okay, and when you read that essay, somehow you made a connection to your book and what message you were sending. What connection did you make?
Sure. So it was a call to arms, and I will I'll read a passage from Andreessen's "It's Time to Build," and he says, "Every step of the way, to everyone around us, we should be asking the question: What are you building? Or are you building directly or helping others build or teaching other people to build?" He goes on and so on and so forth. And I took that personally to say, am I doing my part? Or is Adventure Media doing our part to help move progress, whether it be in our industry, in marketing and advertising, or in the broader ecosystem of where we live and what we can contribute to? And it was a look in the mirror sort of moment. And we had a discussion about it. And then I realized that I was kind of writing the end of a book that is essentially an embodiment of our attempt to build, our attempt to take our small piece of the marketing and advertising industry and make an impact on it in a way that's forcing people to, I think, shake what we would refer to as smug complacency. The entire book of Join or Die is our own opinion on this idea that people have become too comfortable with the status quo. People have been pushing back against changes in technology with machine learning and automation in particular, and not enough people have been willing to go out there and build their own solutions that can leverage this technology to drive better performance for their clients. So I sort of realized that that's essentially what the entire book is about. And it just happened to be at the same time that COVID-19 started taking off, and Marc Andreessen came out with this call to arms, bringing everyone about it. So it was sort of that look in the mirror type of thing. And I looked around and said, we are trying to build something here. And I do believe we have been building something, and I'm quite proud of it. But there's still a lot of work to be done for sure.
I remember in one of the earlier drafts of that last chapter, and it's a personal chapter. It's like you talk about meaningful relationships. I think at some point, or in one of the drafts, you were communicating a feeling that we as an agency haven't built enough yet, or haven't built anything yet. And then you and I were discussing it, and you went back, not because I told you to, just through conversation. This is how I remember it, but I'm told all the time that I have a bit of revisionist history myself. But you changed the chapter, and in the next version, you said that we were building, or we had built already, or at least we built something that you were able to identify. And then the question is, are we helping others build? So what changed? What was that conversation? What was your initial feeling? And then what if anything changed?
That conversation did happen. I do give you the credit for that, because I think that it forced me to really think more about what I was trying to get across. I think I was afraid to attach any confidence to any sort of semblance of we've actually built something or we are building something, because it doesn't feel like that in the day-to-day. It feels like we go through the motions a lot, even though we really aren't. But I think that it was like kind of a vulnerable, insecure type of way for me to say, I would like to build. I aspire to be the kind of person that Marc Andreessen is trying to say is going to, you know, change the world. And to me, that's sort of like the very CEO type of visionary mindset of this is the ideal vision and this is how we should all be acting. And then for me, that's always been like the aspirational. I would like to be able to do that, but realistically, I don't see myself as one of those people. And I think your discussion that you had with me was sort of like, no, realize that we actually are doing something. So I went back to the drawing board and I did realize, like I looked around and said, oh, what we're already doing is very different from what most other folks have been doing in the industry. So I think that there certainly was something to be built upon. And I was holding a book in my hand that actually was something that I built, which I didn't realize at first. And I think your conversation helped me get there.
Andreessen talks about healthcare technology when he references smug complacency. You make an extension. You say that it exists. That smug complacency exists in our industry also, in advertising, in agencies, marketing, maybe more broadly speaking. What do you mean? Where do you really pinpoint where you feel complacency is hampering progress the most, or the most noticeably?
So I think from the top down, it's not just a marketing problem. It comes down from all facets of any larger organization with influence. The reason that innovation generally comes from like small, scrappy companies is because they're the only ones that are motivated to do so, because that's their only way to exist. That's why, I don't know what the example might be. Take Uber, for example. Uber was a small, scrappy startup that disrupted a very lazy industry of transportation that was not delivering a good customer experience. They were not optimizing for modern technology. Just everything about it was just ripe for disruption. They should have optimized themselves, but they weren't motivated to. And I think the reason for that isn't because there's not smart people working at these larger companies. I guess the taxi industry is probably a bad example, but if you take another company that went out of business, maybe Blockbuster being replaced by Netflix, or even a larger incumbent that's going to be challenged by an up-and-coming startup, any company you want to look at, it's not because there's not smart people working in these large companies. It's because that those individuals are not put in a place where they're incentivized to make risky decisions that actually drive innovation. People are happy with the status quo because that's how they earn a paycheck and that's how they go home to their families at the end of the day. And we see it all the time. We work with a lot of larger clients, and this certainly isn't the case across the board, but there are certainly people who their motivation goes from 9 to 5 and then it's over with. And ultimately, they care more about their own career than the success of the company or the industry they work in. Now you multiply that by hundreds of thousands of people that work in a given industry, and you just have no absolute progress. At the marketing and advertising level, I think we've most seen it in terms of people not really caring about driving profit and performance for clients. And this is where my book, Join or Die, comes in. Because over the last maybe 15 to 20 years, advertising got absolutely off the rails and became out of hand, where nobody was held accountable to actually drive performance. They were measuring performance based off of things like impression count, click count, and overall spend. That was loosely correlated to overall revenue that was generated by a given brand. Then you had this instance that took over where people were doing backroom deals and click fraud was becoming a thing. for no other reason than to inflate these artificial numbers to begin with. So people are more incentivized to inflate numbers that weren't even tied to performance to begin with than to try and figure out a new model to actually drive profit and to sell products and services. And that is a huge issue. So you compound that over the course of 15 years and you get to a place where nobody is actually able to profitably sell products online, which gives the opportunity for us, a smaller company, to come through and try and make some disruption happen.
So you're saying a lot here, and some of it's confusing because it's really two sides of this. There's two sides to this story. It's easy to say things, you know, it's easy for Andreessen to talk about smug complacency, but at the end of the day, we're not still like, you know, building Adobe huts and winnowing our fields with, you know, metal rakes. Like, there's been a lot of progress across every industry, but there's also, to some extent, Andreessen talks about, he pokes holes in everything that we've built and seems to point out areas where we've been complacent and unprepared, ill-prepared. So it sounds like what you're saying to me is, while there's been technological advancements going on around the advertising landscape, for example, Google's technology. Like, Google's been hard at work. And maybe Google as a whole, I'm sure Google as a whole, you'll find plenty of people within the organization that are smug and complacent and hanging out at the cafeteria all day. But there's got to be some people at Google that are working hard, that are being driven by whatever incentive structure drives them. But what it sounds like, a lot of people in the agency business, or a lot of people who sit between the technology, or who are using technology but have a moral and fiduciary responsibility to their client, are taking the easy way out and taking from the technological advancements what they could take to make their job easier. Like, let's say your example, we could report now on impressions. Back in the day, when you sold newspaper ads, you couldn't report on impressions. You knew your circulation, but you couldn't report on viewable impressions. You had no way of knowing how many people looked at your ad. And those who were successful then didn't have the facade or the smokescreen that technology provides today with regards to reporting results and showing their clients what was happening. But today, we're what you're describing is a segment or trend that technology is advancing, but clients are actually getting the short end of the stick because agencies aren't doing the hard work of using the technology in a way that best serves the client. Is that what you're saying?
In a way, yes. I don't think that necessarily defines the way I truly feel about it. I think it's a given agency is, or a lot of agencies are incentivized or want to do well for their clients. They want to drive good performance, but they're very risk averse or stuck in their ways and not willing to take big risks or do the hard things, do the challenging things that will help them elevate overall performance to the next level. And I think that's what comes down to the it's time to build conversation. There have been a lot of these things that have been available to us. So let's take, for example, one of the key arguments from the book is that leveraging automated bidding in your Google Ads campaigns will help you drive more profit than using traditional manual bidding type of strategies. Now, a lot of people will say, a lot of agencies at the time will disagree with that statement because they've only seen success with the latter. They've only seen success running manual bidding campaigns, even though I'm telling you that, no, trust me, the other way is better. And they're saying, well, I have experience with that and it's bad. My counter to that argument is that many of those individuals that have been running those campaigns that have tested out automated bidding have not done enough homework to learn how to do that effectively, to learn how to manage those campaigns in a way that helps drive performance. It's not as if you just click two buttons and automatically your campaigns start generating revenue. There's work that's involved. You need to be able to run these campaigns effectively. So that's essentially what the cornerstone of the argument is. You're comfortable where you are and not willing to put in the challenging work to drive real innovation. And that's, I think, the argument of the book, and that's similar to what the argument is in It's Time to Build.
How does an agency overcome that? How does an agency overcome that? Maybe it's laziness, it's complacency. It's just like, I don't want to be bothered. We all know how that feels. This is how we do things. It took a lot of work to figure out how we do things. You know, we've been to conferences and we have our slide decks and we have our clients and things seem to be going okay. What's really the compelling argument to break out of that mold and try new things that are difficult, that likely will fail in the beginning, that will likely take a lot more time? It's unclear what incentives sort of wait on the other end of that journey. What did it for you? What did it for us? What did it for our business?
I think it has to come from the top down. I think it has to come from a true commitment from the leadership to not just embrace change. In this case, it's embracing automation, right? But whatever your industry is, I think it's not just like you have to go all in and you have to be willing to make the short-term sacrifices to be able to do that. We've put in a lot of policies, I guess not like real true policies, but we've put in a lot of guidelines over the years with what kind of clients we bring on, how we manage clients, how we manage campaigns that are hard decisions because it's easier to take a different route. And we've received pushback from our team. We have a lot of people that work here that in the moment, they want to be able to appease a client. And we're saying, no, we have to go a different route. And that's an uncomfortable conversation, but that's the directive that has to come from leadership. I think that's the only way to drive change. But what do you think?
I agree with you. I think there needs to be a culture of change. And I remember a quote about changing one's mind in an that I sent to you and Ari in an email, which outlined an opinion I had about something, which also clearly contradicted an opinion I had about the same thing 48 hours prior. So Ralph Waldo Emerson once wrote, "A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, adored by little statesmen and philosophers and divines." So his point is that only small-minded individuals
can understand what that quote means.
Yeah. Refuse to rethink their prior beliefs or changing their mind. So I think changing one's mind is admirable. Mm-hmm. There's a culture that changing your mind is a sign of weakness. And they say one of the most amazing, outstanding things about Amazon was they maintained this culture of change disproportionately to how big of a business that they became. And it was rare, if not without precedent, to have a company of that size to have that culture of change. We'll just do something differently. We'll do something differently. We'll try this. It'll fail. Change opinions about things. So I think it's true. I think it's a culture of change that small businesses need to conscientiously inculcate. And it does come from the top. Mm-hmm. It's like if you have a boss or there's leadership that have a decision and they can't admit it was wrong, or they can't see the faults in it, or an opinion or a strategy, and then quickly change it and be like, it's not embarrassing. It's nothing to be insecure about. To me, it's just the opposite. Nothing says, or nothing shows confidence in being totally open and willing and quick to completely change your mind and be like, yeah, I said this yesterday, you're right. Because you see people getting into this argument all the time. It's like, you said that. No, I didn't really say that. I didn't really mean that. It's like, no, you misheard me. Prove it. I never said it. Show it to me. It's like, yeah, of course I said that. Yeah, and I'm saying something totally different now. Because I've been alive longer. I read something. I have a richer opinion on the topic. And that's an attitude, I think, which should be encouraged from the top down in a company, where change and looking for opportunities to change is something which is met with excitement, not as a deficiency. Something to be treated as an ideal, not as, a worst case scenario.
All right, but you also have to recognize that change, like anything in change, is going to be harder than the alternative. And that's the scary thing. I think people like the idea of change. People like the idea of failing, right? There's a lot of we've talked about this. There's this like failure pride that like startups have. But ultimately, these types of things are really hard, and you have to have a long-term type of mindset when you go into it. So how do you combat that?
I think it's really hard to see that. I think a person's natural state is change is going to be harder. That remaining with the status quo will be easier. I might not be as successful, but it'll be easier. And there's a natural inclination in the human being to be pulled towards the easy way out. Just ask anyone of us who didn't go to the gym today or whatever. It's like that's just the natural state of things. So I was talking about this morning with somebody regarding our new business process. So we've been doing audits for a long time. You know our audits. And an audit is an important part of winning new business for us. Clients and prospects want to see what our strategic thinking is like what are the areas for opportunity, whether it's in their Facebook campaigns or their Google campaigns or whatever. But we've been doing it the same way for too long. And that itself to me was like getting me uncomfortable. So part of this idea of a culture of change is like if you're a small company and you've been doing it one way for too long, you haven't updated your deck, you haven't changed the way you talk about things, like something's wrong. You got to dig a little bit. It's too stagnant. And when you start thinking that way, it makes it easier. Like you break down the defenses of change a little bit. It's like we're all in this together. I'm not dumping all the responsibility of change and adopting new processes on one person. It's like we're all going to change. We're all looking for ways to change. Change is fun. It's exciting. It's dynamic. You want to move. Change is movement. So part of overcoming it is doing it in a group setting. Like it's we're all changing together. It's going to be difficult, but also fun.
Right. It gets exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
when you put it on one person, it becomes very stressful. But when you do it as a group, it's...
Right. When you put it on one person, it becomes unbearable, almost. If one person's responsible for the change and takes responsibility for the change and for the outcomes, the success or the failure. And there's also a culture of freedom, like freedom to fail if you're changing. Like we speak about this a lot, where if people are making errors, mistakes, typos, whatever it may be, it's like, okay, just don't do it again. So there's very low tolerance here for repeating the same mistake. But we have a very high tolerance, like an unbelievably high tolerance for failure as a result of innovative ideas and change. Because what you learn, it's cliche, it's like a little trite, but what you learn and experience from those misses, it perpetuates the culture that produces the successes, which comes from change, which comes from innovation, change, doing things in a new way. Going back to my conversation earlier this morning, it dawned on me that, and this was a conversation that I had with you a little while ago, that we have to move away from just producing a very technical audit to pitching our business, to pitching the way we think as an agency, to understanding the insight that we'll bring to the table for a new client. Because that's, well, one, it's more fun, it's more exciting. Two, it's what's going to really help us, it's what's going to win us the business when we're being put up against other agencies that could also produce an equally impressive technical audit and an equally impressive list of best practices. And I've had a couple of recent experiences in new business proposals where it's a huge slide deck, you know, a lot of it, the technical audit, but it was just totally clear to me that the only thing the client really latched onto was when I spoke about the way we think about growth, the way we think about strategy, the insights that we want to uncover for their specific business, understanding the competitors. In each case, it was a little bit different, but in two or three recent cases, it was like, it was not the audit or our technical list of best practices, red flags in the account, like do this keyword, whatever. So to me, it just became clear that we have to lean into that movement and figure that out and get better at it. And it's okay. Like if in 2 months from now we're doing, there's also like there's a little bit of a cognitive dissonance thing, I think, at play a little bit, that as far as resistance to change. Because let's just take this example for a second. You could take either example, whether it's we spend 5 years with single keyword ad groups, all these different keyword strategies, courses on the stuff, huge amounts of time spent making YouTube video tutorials, training, talking about it excitedly, and now we're going to do none of that. Or you take the example that we spent years pitching new business in this way, and then in a month from now, we might not do it at all that way. It's very uncomfortable because in a way, by changing, especially when you change dramatically, you're perforce unverbally admitting to some extent that everything we did wasn't as good as it could have been, or it was wrong, or it was wasting time. And any of those dimensions are very uncomfortable cognitively. Like humans are very much motivated to keep their prior behaviors and current behaviors aligned, because we don't like to feel like gross in this contradictory space. Like, well, yesterday I did something really bad. Today I'm not doing something really bad. Does that mean tomorrow I'm going to realize that what I'm doing today is bad? So it's uncomfortable to now say like, okay, it's like looking back at the stock market, right? Like in hindsight, it's like, I could have made those picks. I could have been much better. It's like, I don't even want to look at stocks anymore because I can't deal with how uncomfortable the feeling is of looking back at my wrong picks. So part of, I think, getting behind change is like, yeah, that's okay. That's great. It's good to live that way. It's good to live in contradiction. It's good to admit that what you did wasn't perfect. It's a sign of a mature, forward-thinking, dynamic person and dynamic team. And the other part is also just focusing on the accomplishments. It's two things at the same time, like Ogilvy says, right? It's like an eternal discontent for your work, but it's also being able to appreciate good work. So
let me go into the audit example. So in that, and it's like, okay, well, it's not just this is how we've been doing it for the last 5 years, but it's also the norm in the industry. So when there's a prospect that we would like to sign as a client, this is where it's important for the change to come from the top and to be able to have those uncomfortable conversations and to do those uncomfortable things. So when a salesperson comes and says, hey, listen, like I'm going to do this audit, and you're saying we're not doing these audits anymore, the natural response to that is, yeah, but you have to realize they're getting pitched by these 3 to 5 other agencies that are all doing audits, so we need to do an audit. And I think it's important for us to say no, just because that's how everyone else is doing it. That's literally the definition of smug complacency. We're doing this practice that is antiquated and is not a productive use of time, and in fact takes the conversation away from us being able to highlight the things that we're really good at. So even if a client, like we theoretically, in order to implement change, we need to be willing to occasionally lose business or lose an opportunity because we're drawing a line in the sand with that. Would you say that's a fair statement? Because it is an uncomfortable, and that's a salesperson that's trying to make a commission on signing this business. So that's a line that you have to draw.
Yeah, it's hard to know how to draw that line because when people become too iconoclastic and they're bucking the trends too drastically, then you lose too much business. You know, it's like to some extent you have to conform. Like, okay, we need a website. Our website's got to be navigable. If you're an e-commerce store, just because you think that the shopping cart icon's really cool in the bottom left-hand corner, don't put it there. Like, no matter how cool and individual and like how change-oriented you want to be, there are certain conventions, which is a given. It's like, you know, how you talk and how you present yourself and professionalism and respect. So there's conventions, and it's a hard line to draw which conventions you don't want to meet. And it's part instinct, part experience, part experimentation. And it's part being excited to fail and learn. It's like, yeah, I might lose this business. We're going to do something. When we, with a recent client, they asked for an audit. They're spending like $80,000 a month on Google. They asked for an audit. And they were getting pitched by a number of agencies. And I looked at their account and I saw that like 95% of their search terms were branded. So I wrote them an email, and like this was the first time I ever tried to win an account, and it was like a pretty large account for us without an actual deck. And I sent an email. It's like, my insight is I have nothing to audit. Like, you guys think that you have something to audit here. You're at ground zero. There's nothing to talk about. I don't know what to tell you. Like,
how'd that go?
We got the business. It was a thoughtful email, and I showed them why I couldn't give them an audit.
I was kind of hoping you said you didn't win the business, to be totally honest.
I know. That would drive the point home. But then I went on to explain like how we would strategically go about this, like what we're going to be thinking about, what our process looks like, why I think we're the best team for the job. I gave them some insights that I had as far as their messaging and their overall, you know, budget allocation across the performance channels that we manage. And that was that. And they probably got a lot of technical audits of like, oh, this keyword opportunity, put this negative keyword in, change this bid, add the broad match modifier here. But I think I just maybe not unconventionally cut to the heart of the matter. But you also have to, if you're going to defy, like one of the rules with web design is if you're going to defy a convention, you can. You just have to have a really good reason to do so. Like, not just because you think it looks...
It has to be better.
It has to be better. So to me, I made the judgment call. And the judgment call was, I think that this was going to be a more resonant message to the prospect. Like, that I have nothing to audit. We're starting from ground zero. We have a whole stretch of highway ahead of us. Nothing but blue skies. So let's go. And that was the message I wanted to send. As opposed to an audit that, like, was I knew was going to be dry and something that won't be degrees better than any other audit that they were going to get. So yeah, it's a hard to answer your question. It's a hard line to draw, but I would say the guiding principle would be, if you're going to change, you should be able to explain and understand, or at least feel strongly in your own heart that this is right, that this is better.
So let's tie it back into the "it's time to build" mantra. Mm-hmm. So this came out a little over a year ago. I wrote about it in my book.
Has it been a year since?
No. Well, the essay came out.
Oh, the essay came out.
It's Time to Build came out a year ago.
And how long ago did we publish Join or Die?
November 16th, but who's counting? No, it's July 6th. Okay. Isaac's historically terrible with calendars.
I have no... Yeah, just time and...
Yeah, no, you can't go skiing this month. That's like the only thing that you know. It's like, can I go skiing? Can I not go skiing? Okay, now I have a framework to understand what month of the year it is.
Seasons.
Yeah. So, no, it has not been a year of Join or Die yet. We're coming up on it pretty soon, though. So the real reason that it's come up now back in conversation is because Mark Andreessen last month published another article titled "Technology Saves the World," which I think we can spend an entire episode talking about because it's sort of hilarious and flawed in its own way. But he credits the technology sector for having stepped up in his call to arms to build, and essentially having developed vaccines that helped bring us out of the pandemic. But in addition to that, he credits technology with things like teleconferencing and e-commerce and virtual grocery stores and like basically everything that has allowed our society to continue throughout the pandemic, for better or worse, streaming, internet, things like that. But also in terms of being able to pull us out with vaccines. Now, he's saying that, you know, the tech sector has stepped up to build, and I think that seems fantastic. What's interesting about that, though, is that a lot of these pieces were already in place. Zoom was already a company. Shopify was already a company. A lot of companies were already earning their keep running digital advertising campaigns. I'm curious what you think as far as why did it take a pandemic to force that change? Because it was there all along, and I think that there wasn't enough motivation to drive that through. And I guess my real question is, going back to this whole conversation about how to force change in an organization, I think it's really hard, whether it comes from the top down, and we can say all these things, but what really does help drive people to change their ways and embrace the new challenging things?
Well, there's two levels to this, I think. One is, like you said, these companies primarily existed already, right? So we had Shopify, we had Zoom, we had Google Hangout, we have Instacart. So technology was making huge strides, and in the efficiencies and conveniences that we have today. And like you pointed out in one of your recent Slack updates, it's not that complicated. Like, good marketing, like you said, caters to the human condition. It's the message, like the didactic message of be responsible, sacrifice yourself for the greater good. It's like, it's nice in a tweet. It's not real. It's not real. No one thinks that way throughout the Dalai Lama does, but like you and I don't think that way throughout the course of a day. Like, we're just trying to make it back to bed in one piece. And if I could reduce my carbon footprint by selling me a car that goes from 0 to 60 in 2 seconds, like the Tesla, and that could be a really cool thing for me to have, and as a byproduct, there's less harm to the environment, then that's how you market the product. Like, that's how you get people to adopt it.
Right. Because anything, whether it's, and I guess this ties it together, right? So like selling a change in your organization, like, hey, we're not going to do auditing, or selling a Tesla, still requires a level of marketing. You have to be able to frame the messaging here. And in order to foster change, whether it be behaviorally within an organization, or you're trying to motivate change in terms of getting somebody to buy something, it all comes down to marketing and messaging.
100%. And the idea of, like, the idea of selling change in an organization or culturally, it'll never work if you get up on the pulpit and you say everyone has to change because change is the mark of a great organization. It's if people see in actuality their leaders embracing change and their leaders admitting failure and their leaders trying to find new things to do and to test and to learn, people are going to get excited and they're going to want to follow and be a part of that type of dynamic. But as far as the pandemic, I think it's like nothing moves, nothing changes without pressure applied to it. It's just a rule. People, like, I think there's such a thing as intrinsic motivation, but I would also say that comes from pressure. People who are intrinsically motivated, their DNA isn't different. I think that they're more, they apply pressure on themselves. They don't need extrinsic pressure. They don't need, you know, they don't need quarantine in order for them to find time to spend with their family. Like, they put pressure on themselves to find time to spend with their family. But it's pressure. People change and people move because of pressures. So the pandemic, which really, look, we had this with Perfumania, right? So Perfumania is one of the largest retail footprints in America of perfume, cologne, fragrances. They shut down 300 plus brick and mortar stores because they had to. And all of a sudden, you now have a pressure that didn't exist before to figure out their online platform, which they didn't really stress that much because they didn't have to. They had a successful retail business. Sure, was the idea of selling online successfully always good? It was always good, but there wasn't enough pressure. And this is a major oversimplification because you have to have like the attitudes of the shareholders, you have to have the market dynamics, you have to have like metrics being hit or not hit. There's many different variables in this equation, but ultimately the pressure was not strong enough to compel a change that just wouldn't have happened if things had remained as they were. So comes along the pandemic and it just closes the door forcefully on all of these business opportunities and all these sort of normal ways of living. And I think it's like an enormously motivating and inspiring thing to see that the entrepreneurial traits that were revealed within people is inspirational. Like, that some of these companies, even the big companies, were able to hustle in the way they did while being remote, while being sick or having family or friends that were sick, like, right? Like, the country was in turmoil. It's a real point of distinction between types of people who fold and can't get up and can't do anything and are overcome with anxiety and fear. And I'm not saying that that's not a legitimate reaction, but then there was the whole other side of things throughout the pandemic of people who were really kicked into high gear, whether it was to help out with communities, with healthcare, with business operations. So I think, to Andreessen's point, we do find a lot of smug complacency, but I think at the same time, we find an incredible amount of innovation and inspiration if you're aware and excited about feeling that pressure to change. So if you welcome that pressure and you could somehow orient yourself psychologically that it's not bad or scary, but it's good, it's the only thing that's going to produce a better version of myself or a better version of my business, then I think that's, you're three quarters of the way towards changing. You just see it as something which is exciting. I feel this is the same way in relationships, that the only thing that could produce close, like the next degree of closeness between two people, is being faced with an obstacle that those two people together overcome. Like, it's the opposite of the narrative that we see in Hollywood, that like, oh, we're just a fit. We just fit like two puzzle pieces. And then like, there's no greater formula for success than that. It's just the exact opposite. That the puzzle piece people will have the hardest time getting close. Because what is the pressure? What's the substance that forces people to become close? It's overcoming obstacles. It's change. It's the same thing in a business. The same thing with any sort of progress. So that's my thing on that.
I like it. And I think it's that pressure, it needs to exist. Like, innovation doesn't happen because larger companies, governments, don't have the pressure that they're necessarily going to go out of business tomorrow or next week. It takes something as large as a pandemic or a very innovative company like Netflix to come along and put you out of business. But hey, I don't see that on the horizon. So like, what's my motivation to do that right now? And I think that something that I try and keep in mind as much as possible is that idea that, like, sure, we're a smaller growing company, but at some point there's going to be another smaller growing company that's going to be trying to put us out of business. And that's something that I've tried to keep in mind. Again, this is something I reference in the book, but in 2016, we were at the HubSpot Inbound Conference and Gary Vaynerchuk gave the keynote speech and he talked about this exact topic. And he said, if you're not trying to put yourself out of business, somebody else will. And to me, I thought like, oh my God, this is, yeah, like that's me. That's like, where are the ones that are going to be putting people out of business? Never realizing for a second that we could be on the other end of that. And it wasn't until a few years had gone by where I started to look around and realize that that is always a real threat. And I think that level of like anxiety to a degree has been motivating. And that is why we are constantly looking at almost everything we do and saying, I'm ready to throw this process in the trash. I'm ready to get rid of that technology. I'm ready to, you know, start embracing this new type of advertising immediately, because everything that we do now is not going to be protected forever and we need to be willing to change. Otherwise, somebody else is going to come and innovate us away.
I really like that. And I remember that speech by Gary Vaynerchuk. And I remember saying years ago, three offices ago, like, don't tell clients we're an AdWords company. Don't put that on our website. Yeah. Like, we're not an AdWords company because we will be out of business very soon.
AdWords won't exist anymore. And then it didn't, because it's been Google Ads for 3 or 4 years.
Right. And I think that if you're just... I see this on the horizon, like a real, not a leveling of the playing field, a winnowing of the playing field. Because as cookies go away, you're going to lose a lot of these like fluffy technology companies that just plug into the same ad networks and charge, pump up the arbitrage and the auctions with cookie-based personalized targeting. It's going to go back to insight-based contextual targeting. At least that's the trend. Google's going to become more automated, where it's like there's less like... And we're absolutely seeing that. Like, it's clear as day over the last few years. Like, that's what's happening. So I think that's really true. I think successful businesses have that attitude. And I'm not saying that there are not any sycophantic, megalomaniac corporate CEOs in America today. But the media, they're too quick to dismiss large businesses as being just like driven for power, where you see Amazon, Google, Apple, right? Like these are big, big businesses. And now, I don't know if you saw in the Wall Street Journal, there's a big move to break up these monopolies mm-hmm. by government. And there was an interesting article like that sort of outlined like what specifically would change if Amazon was now two separate companies, one for thirds, whatever. But we look at the founders and be like, they're just obsessed about power. I think there's more to the story. These are people from the very beginning were afraid of being put out of business.
Yeah.
And that fear drives them now the same way it drove them. Like, I remember seeing this about Steve Jobs, and say about him what you will. Like, he could have been it seems like he was a pretty horrible person. But he, when he was Apple, like, he would talk about, like, the last few years of his life, like, little lawsuits going on and, like, whatever, like, as if he was, like, the victim. But I don't think it was, like, a sycophantic thing. Like, I think he really felt this same urgency, drive, someone's going to put me out of business. Someone's going to put me out of business. So, of course, it's an attitude that has to be tempered with humanity. But you're right. Like, I think it's true that the feeling, the antidote to that, going back to the beginning, which is complacency, is a feeling of divine, eternal discontent. My work could be better. My business could be better. I could be better. And I think when looked at in the right way, that feeling could be a true source of inspiration and positive emotion, as opposed to negative emotion and a downward spiral, which it sometimes could become also. So that's it for today. Let's pause. It's a lot of stuff to talk about and to open up and to continue with. You've been listening to the How to Hide a Dead Body podcast. Once again, pick up your copy of Join or Die, Digital Advertising in the Age of Automation, in hardcover on Amazon.com, written by Patrick Gilbert. And last question, as we inaugurate our podcast studio, it's coming along with our Sennheiser products. That's not a paid promotion. Sennheiser is our proud client. What's the best place to hide a dead body?
Well, prior to today, I would have said in the back room of our office that had just been like a storage closet. But now that we've made it into this beautiful podcast studio, I can confidently say that it's on the second page of Google.
Very nice. We'll see you guys in the next episode.